I invite you to take a Bible and open to the minor prophet Hosea as we continue our study. This book, we'll be looking at chapter 5 tonight. Last week with chapter 4, we noted that God had an indictment against Israel. He had, in a sense, mounted evidence in order to, as we might think of it, take Israel to court on charges of infidelity and unfaithfulness to him. At chapter 5, it's as though the evidence is now being considered and unfolded, and we see the crimes that this nation was guilty of in their relationship with God. And so I've entitled this chapter, as we'll see as we go through tonight, that nobody is innocent from the top to bottom. Nobody is innocent. So all will suffer the consequences. And we really get into the heart of the evidence in God's case against them tonight. You can divide this chapter into two parts, verses 1 through 7. We'll see that they are corrupt to the core. And no class of people. They are named specifically in the first part of the chapter, but no class of people are without guilt in their behavior and the outcome of their behavior. And then verses 8 through 15, the punishment of Israel or for Israel is sure. It's certain. And you can count on that with anything. If God has said it or God has promised it, it's sure. It's going to happen. I think it best tonight just to work through the verses. They going to handle themselves individually rather than in groups. So we'll go through the text, reading it, and then making the observations and drawing out the lessons that are to be learned there. Look at verse 1. Hear this, O priest. Take heed, O house of Israel. Give ear, O house of the king, for yours is the judgment. Because you have been a snare to Mizpah and a net spread on Tabor. There are a few things here. First, notice the three classes of people that are indicted by God here. There are the priest, there's the royal family, and then there is the people of the nation. And they're all guilty. God calls all of them to the witness stand to hear the charges that he levels against them. We know just by virtue of the fact that it's the northern kingdom, which is typically referred to Israel, and also in the book of Hosea as Ephraim. Those two terms are used interchangeably in reference to this people. But you'll remember, after the United Kingdom, when the kingdom divided with Jeroboam taking the northern tribes and Rehoboam remaining in the south, the southern tribes, that some drastic changes took place regarding the religious and worship system of the northern tribes. You likely will also remember that every one of the kings of the northern tribes were corrupt and evil. And also, from the outset, the religious system that was put in place, the priests, were wrong. We know that under the law of Moses, the priestly obligations were reserved for the Levites, those from the tribe of Levi. But here we see that the priests were wrong from the outset. Let me give you a couple of verses for this. In 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 31, relative to what Jeroboam did, the Bible says he made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. And if that description weren't bad enough, listen to what 1 Kings 13:33 says. He made priests from every class of people for the high places. Whoever wished, he consecrated him, and he became one of the priests of the high places. So it didn't matter. This was not, as far as the northern kingdom was concerned, the office of priest or those responsibilities that were given to the Levites who had been trained and educated in their responsibilities, There was no resume under Jeroboam's reign. There were no qualifications. If you wanted to be priest, guess what? You could be priest. It didn't matter what your lineage was or anything of that nature. All that seemingly was required was the desire to do it. And don't get me wrong. Desire is a great thing. You know, in Paul's instruction to Timothy and Titus with regard to the qualifications of one who would be a leader of God's people, preeminent among those qualifications is the desire to do it. But it's not just desire. It's not just desire relative to elders, and it's not just desire relative to the office of priest and the worship practices of the Israelites. Those matters were reserved for the Levites. So we notice at the outset that the priests were wrong to begin with. And it's impossible to start out wrong in that regard and somehow get it right or end up right from there. Again, he indicts the kings, the royal family, the house of the kings. Every single king was evil, rejecting the true God. In the southern kingdom, we notice that some are good, some are bad. But with regard to the kings of the northern tribes, every single one of them was bad. And in fact, the common refrain in a description of their work in the northern kingdom is such as is found in 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 52, where it says, and of each of these, he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He walked in the way of his father and in the way of his mother, and in the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. That was consistent from start to finish, up until the time that God sends these people into Assyrian captivity. None of their leadership was either qualified or concerned about the will of the God of heaven. So the priest, the kings, but also the people. Notice they're not absent in the indictment. They're included as well. The people evidently did not complain about it. They were okay with it, and they went along with the system that Jeroboam had set up and that the priest led them in. This statement is said of the southern kingdom in Jeremiah chapter 5, verses 30 through 31, but it is applicable to the situation with regard to the northern kingdom. There Jeremiah said, an astonishing and horrible thing has been committed in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely. The priests bear rule by their own power. Now listen. And my people love to have it so. And what will they do in the end thereof? The people loved it. And so they're just as guilty as the classes, the priests and the kings that were mentioned in the indictment. Look at the idea of Mizpah and Tabor. Those were two mountain ranges or peaks on which idolatry was practiced by the people of the land. So they are brought out in the indictment as places where the people of God were ensnared and trapped by the ungodly behavior of the ones who had formerly lived there. Now look at verse 2. The revolters are deeply involved in slaughter, though I rebuke them all. It appears that they're successful, despite the fact that God is against them. They are deeply involved in slaughter. They're getting their way. They are accomplishing the things that they are setting out to accomplish. And you would think, well, since God's not knocking them over, that he must approve of their behavior. But looks can be deceiving. And just because they are seeing some success seemingly in their practices doesn't mean God approves. And the fact that they're here now being charged by God is evidence that he did not approve. Look at verse 3. I know Ephraim and Israel is not hidden from me. Again, using those two terms interchangeably, referencing the same group of people. The point is, God clearly sees. He doesn't miss anything. He knows exactly what's going on, and you cannot hide corruption from God. And that same principle applies to us today. We can't hide corruption from God. I think of passages like Hebrews chapter 3, verse 14, that no creature is hidden from his sight. All things are naked and open to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Every man and woman, accountable person, will give an account to God one day. We can't conceal corruption in our lives. This nation didn't get away with it, and we should expect that nobody can. Let's continue on. Verse 3 says, the latter part of verse 3, "For now, O Ephraim, you commit harlotry. Israel is defiled." Look at verse 4. "They do not direct their deeds toward turning to their God, for the spirit of harlotry is in their midst, and they do not know the Lord." They're so enmeshed in the pagan practices of the people of the land that they can't let it go. That's reminiscent of what Peter said in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 14, about people who have eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls. They have a heart trained in covetous practices and are accursed children. Same with the Israelites here. God had tolerated. God had been long-suffering. He had waited and consulted with the people through the prophets that he had sent to them. But nothing was accomplished. They didn't change because their hearts were set on those evil practices. There are a lot of lessons to be learned here. You know, we may think, If we're doing something that's not in line with the will of God, and the fact that we're allowed to persist in it, we might be like them and think, well, it must be okay because, you know, I'm being allowed to continue to do it. And then we are totally engulfed in the behavior and can't quit even if we wanted to. We get so enmeshed in the attractiveness and the lure of transgression of God's will that we can't even see our own problems. Look at verse 4. They're unconvinced of their sinfulness. Think about others who had been tempted and enticed by sin, who didn't seemingly see the problem with it because of the seductive, luring nature of sin. Look at Eve. You think it ever entered into her mind what was going to happen as a consequence of disobeying God by taking the bait that Satan put before her? Think about David, the king, who considered something that he might do with a woman that wasn't his wife. You think it ever entered into his mind the consequences that would come from that? Probably not. He knew it was wrong. But who sits down and lays out all the consequences and the repercussions of sinful behavior before they do it? I think rarely do people do that. Israel certainly didn't. Jeroboam never weighed the consequences of substituting worship. He never weighed the consequences of establishing a priesthood based upon unqualified volunteers. The people likely never thought about the consequences of their going along with that plan just because it was convenient for them. And that's the nature of sin. There's a seeming innocence of deception that just reaches out and it grabs you and pulls you in. We need to be careful. We need to learn the lessons from this people and look how far they got away from God without intending to get that far away from God. And now they're on the receiving end of God's judgment because of their behavior. Look at verse 5. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Therefore Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with them. You remember, this message is primarily for the northern kingdom, but Judah gets a taste of it, interspersed in the messages here as a warning not to go in the same direction. But look at that statement for a moment. The pride of Israel, their pride, what does their pride do? Pride does a lot of things. But what does it do in this case? It testifies to his face. Pride can testify to the face of God as it does here for them. And this is not just a message for nations, but us as well. What about our pride? You know, we can be prideful. We can be arrogant and stubborn in our own will. Why would it not also be true that that behavior would testify to the face of God? Especially in light of passages like Psalm verse 10 and 4. The wicked in his proud countenance does not seek God. God is in none of his thoughts. Proverbs chapter 16 verse 18 says, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. If we are prideful, we need to get rid of that. We need to set it aside and put on a spirit of humility because of the way pride looks from the perspective of God. It testifies before his face. God put up with it. His long-suffering tolerated it for a time to give people an opportunity to turn from their wicked ways, but they're not going to. Look at verse 6. With their flocks and herds, they shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find him. He has withdrawn himself from them. It almost seems instinctive to wait too late. You know, it really does. It seems instinctive to wait till the very last minute before pulling back from a situation of danger. And here you have a nation of people who ride all the way up to the edge of the cliff. But the momentum, at the moment where it seems like they're trying to suggest they're going to turn around, the momentum takes them right over the edge because they've gone to the point where God says, that's as far as I was willing to go. And he gives them up. And he does not hear their petition or their cry. An interesting passage in this light is Proverbs chapter 1, verses 24 through 28. Listen to what the Proverbs writer says. Because I have called and you refused, I have stretched out my hand and no one regarded. Because you disdained all my counsel and would have none of my rebuke, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your terror comes. When your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind. When distress and anguish come upon you, then they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me. People might say, well, how is that acceptable that God is not willing to hear when people call on him? This is how and why it's acceptable. Because if it gets to that point, you can be sure God has given ample opportunity for people to listen and to turn. It's like in Romans chapter 1, in describing the sinful condition of the Gentile nation. The Bible says that God gave them up to a reprobate mind to do those things which are unfitting. They didn't start that way with God, but they moved so far away from him that they got to the point where their momentum took them all the way. And God said, I'm done. You've tested me and you've rejected me. Now you've been tested and I reject you as well. Nation, priesthood, royal family, individuals like you and me even today, and congregations, better not test God and try to ride to the limit of ungodliness, thinking that they or we can get away with it. God will give us up to the consequences of our own choices. And then verse 7, They have dealt treacherously with the Lord, for they have begotten pagan children. Now a new moon shall devour them and their heritage. Some translations, instead of pagan children, have strange children. They're pagan or strange in the sense that they have no relationship with God. Nobody taught them about God. And so now they're strangers to God. They don't have a clue who the true God of heaven is. It's often been said that a people are just one generation away from apostasy or complete separation from God. And I think just thinking about that, you could see how that could be true. You just stop teaching your children and see what happens. We are not that protected. We are not that sure in our future if we don't teach and if we don't educate. Here's a prime example of a people who didn't teach their children about the God of heaven, and now God says they're strangers. They might as well be pagans. They might as well be on par with the people of the land that I commanded you to eject, because they have no better relationship with me than those people do. Can we just ask ourselves a question? How close are we to that? I mean, these things aren't written in a corner, brethren. These things apply to us. How close are we to the point where our children are not really any different than the children in the world? And how much lax parenting and godly guidance and instruction will be necessary for them to be just like the kids of this day who are strangers to God? We have a tremendous responsibility, and our work is cut out for us to make sure that God never looks down on the children of the Lord's church in any generation and says, they're strangers to me. Something to think about. Verses 1 through 7, they're corrupt to the core. No class was innocent, from the top to the bottom, from the leadership to the priest to the people to their children. They were all corrupt to the core. Now look at verses 8 through 15. The punishment of Israel is sure. Let's begin in verse 8. Blow the ram's horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah. Cry aloud at Bethaven. Look beyond you, behind you, O Benjamin. The instruments here are not instruments of worship. They are instruments of warning in this case. Blow the trumpet. Why? Because an instrument of God is coming to punish, to afflict, and to take these people into captivity because they have ignored the God of heaven. And so warn that the enemy is coming. Also, you have Gibeah and Ramah. Those are situated, interestingly, in Benjamin, in the border of these two tribes. But look what he says. Look behind you, Benjamin. What's the significance of this? Well, not now with Israel, when they go into captivity, but eventually the southern kingdom is going to go into Babylonian captivity. And here's a warning for you. Look behind you. See what's happening with the nation to the north. Because if you don't get it together, the same is going to be your lot as well. In verse 8 also, notice the terminology Bethaven. That's a term synonymous with the city of Bethel. But Bethel means the house of God. Bethaven means the house of emptiness. And so here's a house that's supposed to be the dwelling place of God, and yet it's not. It's empty. You open the doors and you look in and there's nothing, because God is not in there. Now look at verse 9. Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel I make known what is sure. God knows in advance. God knows what's going to happen. Righteous people will be rewarded. Wicked people will be punished. We have the same kind of warnings in the New Testament. John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in the graves will hear his voice and do what? They'll come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. It's no mystery, right? It's not. We're not scratching our heads tonight saying, I wonder what will happen when God judges. And for people who reject God and turn away from his guidance and instruction, I'm scratching my head. I'm wondering what's going to happen. And what about people who know the Lord, who seek his will, and who pursue it in their life? I wonder what's going to happen. We don't have to wonder. He's told us. He's told us for our own generation, and he's demonstrated it in the ones that went before us. Romans 15:4, it's written for our learning. God has not tolerated wickedness. He's handled it accordingly, and he's the same God today that he was then, and he will handle these matters just the same. Look at verse 11, or verse 10 rather. The princes of Judah are like those who remove a landmark. I will pour out my wrath on them like water. An interesting illustration here, a landmark. You don't see them much anymore today. In fact, they just take a steel rod typically and drive it down in the ground where you can't see it to mark a landmark. But I'm pretty sure I've told in past sermons about the concrete monument that was like 4 inches by 4 inches square that was at the end of our driveway when I was growing up. And I had tried and tried and tried as a kid to move that thing. I didn't know, it's just a piece of concrete as far as I was concerned. It was many years later I learned it's a landmark. It demonstrates where the dividing line is between properties. The significance of that with the Israelites is their land boundaries were defined by God. And they were permanent for those tribes of people. So anyone who tried to move or tried to take control of the land of someone else was prohibited. You remember how Ahab had Naboth killed so he could take his vineyard. That wasn't Ahab's land. And so here, in trying to help our minds understand the significance of this matter, the prophet says the princes of Judah are like those who remove a landmark. They steal away and they lie about the truth of matters of importance and significance. In effect, they're changing God's law. They've moved landmarks. And I would just give you passages like 2 John verse 9 that talk about abiding in the doctrine of Christ. That's how we know we have God and that our relationship is right with him, by abiding, not moving the landmarks regarding the doctrine of God's teaching in his word. Now look at verse 11. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked by human precept. He walked according to his own way, and Jeroboam led the way in that falling away from God. He changed everything about worship and set up idols in the northern kingdom so that the people didn't have to go to Jerusalem to worship. That was all human precept, human instrumentality, human thinking, and it rejected the way of God. But Israel willingly followed, and so they're guilty too. You think about in a congregation where the leadership, the preacher, or some element within the congregation rises up and starts teaching something that's not consistent with the Word of God. Do you follow that? You better not. You can't say, well, I wasn't leading in it. You know, I just kind of went along. You can't do that. They're guilty from the top to bottom, and congregations, and there are some in our area, that allow that kind of nonsense to take place, they're guilty. from the top to the bottom for allowing it to take place. Israel let themselves fall to pieces rather than rejecting the ridiculous and ungodly behavior of those who led them. Look at verses 12 to 13. Therefore, I will be to Ephraim like a moth, and to the house of Judah like rottenness. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to King Jareb, yet he cannot cure you nor heal you of your wound. There was a practice in those days, kind of like even in our day with allies, to where when a nation of people were threatened by attack, they would go and make alliances with other nations. And those alliances were used to help them defend themselves. So here, God is promising an attack. He's promising that this nation, an instrument in his hand, is going and to come and to destroy. And what do? They're going in a couple of directions to look for alliances, of all things, to try to help defend themselves against divine judgment. And interestingly, the Jareb may be probably something to do with Egypt. Egypt was a typical alliance in those days, but also to Assyria, the very instrument that God is going to use against them. But notice, he cannot cure you nor heal you of your wound. If God's judgment is against a nation, then there's nothing they can do save repenting to stay that judgment and the execution of it. Verse 14, for I will be like a lion to Ephraim, and like a young lion in the house of Judah, I will tear them and go away. I will take them away, and no one shall rescue. Again, no help will be available. No help will be sufficient when God comes in judgment against them. And then verse 15, I will return again to my place till they acknowledge their offense. Then they will seek my face, and their affliction they will earnestly seek me. God had provided them with every possible warning. Some 20 years later, Assyria is going to come and decimate the northern kingdom and take them into captivity. They've missed their opportunity. And it would be long after the point of this warning, long after the point of no return, that they would sit down and analyze their situation, and as verse 15 says, acknowledge their offense so that they might seek my face and their affliction and earnestly seek me. Too late. So here we have the fact that everybody is guilty. We begin to unfold the crimes of which they are guilty. Much attitude and behavior that is typical of people today, and is something that we have to be concerned about and make sure that we're not guilty of these same kinds of transgressions, because God has demonstrated adequately in these verses that he's not for it and he'll not tolerate it. There's so much about this that is timely and amazingly familiar for us today. There's much to learn as we consider the historic dealings of God with people who tried to reject him and avoid his judgment. May God help us not to be of that mind, for instance, on an individual basis. May God help us to realize that we will not succeed if we reject his will and expect to escape his judgment in the final day. Might we have the mentality that says, whatever God expects of me, that's what I'm going to do. Whether it's obey the gospel as one who's never become a Christian, or as a Christian who has stepped out of duty to God, may it be in our heart to get our lives right with him and learn from these great lessons of man's past. Maybe you have such a need tonight. We're going to sing a song to encourage. If we can assist you, won't you make that known as we stand and sing?